There's ash all over the railings, all over the doghouses, all over the truck. It was a little spooky.
A wildfire burning near Fairbanks may force evacuations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, astronaut Mark Kelly makes the case in Alaska for better gun control.
We did a poll here in Alaska and it's 72% support a expanded background check. But we still were unable to get it passed in the Senate.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The Stewart Creek fire, burning on military land east of Eielson Air Force Base, has tripled in size over the last 3 days. An evacuation watch has been issued for people living along a 16-mile stretch of Chena Hot Springs Road because of the wildfire. Pete Buist is a fire information officer with Alaska's Interagency Fire Information Center at Fort Wainwright.
That fire started on June 19th, but it hadn't been very active for quite a while. On Sunday and then again on Monday, it breached control lines to the north and west and made a really spectacular run. It exhibited extreme fire behavior, burning in continuous black spruce.
The human-caused fire has since grown to 45,000 acres. An enormous cloud of smoke is visible from the west side of Fairbanks. Ash fell from the sky along Chena Hot Springs Road yesterday. Scott Chesney lives just shy of milepost 15.
It was kind of interesting because it was almost like a little snowfall, little bits of ash and burned leaves and such falling from the sky. There's ash all over the railings, all over the doghouses, all over the truck. It was a little spooky.
The fire is burning within 15 miles of Two Rivers. The tiny community has barely recovered from a wildfire scare last month that prompted an evacuation notice. Chesney says his belongings are packed.
So, yeah, I mean, we've got the stuff ready to go, you know, load the truck. I've still got, you know, I got a neighbor who, she took the dog box off her truck, so we loaded up a spare dog box on her snow machine trailer, and that's sitting there ready to go, and we're just, you know, we know what to grab and what to go. So, you know, if we need to, we could be ready in probably 20 minutes, 25 minutes to bail.
Multiple retardant tankers and water scoopers worked the fire through Sunday evening. Smoke jumpers and bulldozers were also fighting the blaze yesterday. A helicopter was used to map it. Officials with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center say fighting the fire is challenging because of the threat of unexploded ordnance on military land. Smoke from another wildfire, the Skinnies Road fire, burning between Fairbanks and Nenana, means the State Department of Transportation is still using pilot cars to lead traffic through smoky conditions along the park's highway between mileposts 322 and 332 from 6 a.m. until midnight. A team from Oregon's State Department of Forestry is managing the nearly 1,700-acre human-caused blaze. Officials predict the fire will be under control by July 4th. There are currently more than 100 wildfires burning statewide. Former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly spent today in Anchorage, the second stop on their seven-state rights and responsibilities tour. The two are trying to gather support for their push to require expanded background checks for gun buyers. But as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, Alaska's congressional delegation is not on board.
Giffords and Kelly's gun reform group, Americans for Responsible Solutions, claims that new poll numbers indicate Americans are warming to the concept of expanded background checks for new gun owners. Giffords and Kelly met with just under a dozen Alaska gun owners before allowing questions from the press at a downtown park. Giffords did not speak to reporters, but Kelly said he and his wife were in the state to gauge Alaskans' attitudes towards stricter gun control.
You know, I did a little poll there, and in that group anyway, there were 11 folks, and All 11 of them think that we should have background checks for pretty much all gun sales. You know, sales that happen on the internet and at gun shows. And, you know, that's something that, you know, 92% of the country supports. We did a poll here in Alaska, and it's 72% support a expanded background check. But we still were unable to get it passed in the Senate.
Kelly says that despite the fact that a recent gun control bill failed in the U.S. Senate, he is going to continue to work for expanded background checks for new gun buyers.
So we've got some more work to do, obviously. But some of the unique stuff that we heard, I found it pretty interesting from one gentleman who is an avid hunter, who hunts for food, you know, moose and bear. And he had this interesting comment that he said he would never become a member of the NRA because while the NRA tends to support candidates that are, you know, pro gun rights and Second Amendment rights, he says those same people tend to be really bad on the environment.
Kelly says a rural exemption was put in the failed bill that would have allowed rural gun buyers to forego background checks, as would those handing down guns from parents to children. Kelly also says he has not met personally with Senators Mark Begich or Lisa Murkowski, both of whom voted against the Senate bill. Kelly says he'll continue to try to sway Begich to support greater gun control. Giffords and Kelly kicked off their tour in Nevada. They head next to North Dakota. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Efforts to boom off the overturned fishing tender near the mouth of the Ugishic River proved unsuccessful Monday night. The next plan of attack is to use divers to plug the vents on the vessel's fuel tanks. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
A small sheen was observed Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday coming off the Lone Star, and the effort to stop the spread of that sheen got started Monday night when boom was deployed around the vessel. The boom didn't stick in place, and it's now missing. The next plan is to use divers to plug up the vents on the vessel's fuel tanks. Eventually, all of the fuel on board the Lone Star will need to be removed, and the vessel will have to be moved from its current location in the mouth of the Ugishic River. John Brown with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation confirms that world-renowned salvage company Magone Marine has been hired by the Coast Guard to remove the petroleum products off the Lone Star.
I'm pretty confident. I've worked with Dan Magone now for 20 years, and we've worked a lot tougher ones than this. Certainly the currents is a new twist on it, and that diving is going to probably be some of the most dangerous diving that we've done. And those currents and the lack of visibility, there's a lot of issues that Dan's going to have to deal with, and we're going to only have short windows of time to be able to do that, and that's just going to be a slack water at the low tide or maybe at the high tide where we just have just a very short window.
It's believed that the Lone Star is carrying around 14,000 gallons of diesel fuel, 250 gallons of gasoline, 150 gallons of hydraulic oil, and 150 gallons of lubricating oils. Most, if not all, of those petroleum products are thought to still be contained on the vessel. Brown confirms that the petroleum products causing the light sheen seen in the vicinity of the Lone Star are not recoverable.
The very light silver sheen is even tough to pick up with absorbent pads. Yeah, there's no mechanical devices that will pick up that silver sheen. So the pads is our absorbent sashi boom is our best option for that light of a sheen.
One of the big concerns with the Lone Star is the vessel moving around with the tides. On Monday, it was sitting with the bow below the water and much of the stern above the waterline. However, the latest observations show the vessel is now completely on its side. The concern is that if the vessel moves around, the fuel tanks could be damaged, resulting in a release of petroleum products into the sensitive waters of the Ugishic River. So far, no contaminated fish or other wildlife have been spotted. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
State Representative Les Guerra hasn't ruled out a possible run for governor next year. The Anchorage Democrat says two important conditions exist for him in deciding whether to run. One is that he would have to talk it over more extensively with his wife. The other has to do with other Democrats in the race. Guerra says if the Democrats field a really good candidate, he'd rather work to get them elected. He cited as possible examples of this Senators Hollis French and Senator Bill Willikowski. Guerra last week filed a letter of intent to run for office next year, but left the office blank. He said he's hoping either French or Willikowski runs and says 4 years from now is probably the better time for him to seriously consider running for governor. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, restoring an historic airplane that crashed near Fairbanks 44 years ago.
If you find a center section of a B-25 somewhere, go get it, because whatever money's going to be spent is going to be less than recreating it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
An Oklahoma company's plan to mine gold from a large area around Yakutat is dead. But there's still interest in smaller operations near the northern southeast community, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Walk along the water at Yakutat Strawberry Point and you'll see a well-used fish camp. Miniature houses with windows and siding stand next to wall tents, Quonset huts, and weather-damaged cabins. There's plenty of driftwood for fires, wildflowers for photos, and seabirds for watching.
He does, you know, silhouette. He does look a little bit like a cormorant.
It does, yeah.
There's also plenty of sand. Sand, one company claimed, could bring Yakutat one hell of an economic boom.
The preliminary sampling shows a potentially commercial deposit of gold and silver on the surface.
That's Tim Cannon of Cross Timbers Forestry in a 2009 interview. His Oklahoma firm conducted fieldwork for Geohedral LLC, which staked claims on about 60,000 acres around Yakutat. The area included beaches, upland dunes, and a nearby mesa. Geohedral said it found strong evidence of gold, silver, iron, and titanium worth a king's ransom. Well, maybe Bill Gates or Warren Buffett's ransom. And then...
it went from something like a $40 billion project to nothing practically overnight.
That's Skip Ryman, manager of Yakutat's borough government.
It had potential to get people really excited and stir up a lot of controversy, but the town held its own. It sat there and said, well, let's wait and see.
Conservation and native groups raised environmental concerns, but backers spread the news that assays, tests that determine mineral content, suggested there could be 35 million ounces of gold. That's about 1,000 tons. Then came word of follow-up tests showing much less mineral content, not enough to be worth mining. Yakutat Municipal Planner Bill Lucy says eventually, Geohedral gave up its claims.
After some of the reports from both the state DNR and the Forest Service mining permitting people expressing doubt, the company went away.
A call to Geohedral's Oklahoma City headquarters was answered by Herb Mee Jr. He was the president of the Beard Company, a major investor, when the claims were filed. He declined to be interviewed, but he confirmed the Yakutat mining claims were not maintained and the effort is long over. Meanwhile, court documents show the Beard Company filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy last fall. That usually leads to liquidation. Yakutat's Lucy says others remain interested in mining, but on a far, far smaller scale.
Those are small mom-and-pop operations. A lot of it's beach placer mining with a pan after a storm, and they can get some pretty good amount of gold up there.
He's seen interest in dredge mining at the Alsek River to the east and the White River to the west, but nothing's happened so far. Lucy also staffs the fisheries advocacy group, Yakutat Salmon Board. He says an operation like Geohedral's could harm fish and wildlife, as well as subsistence and commercial harvests. But small dredge mining could be done in a way that would not damage salmon habitat. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Yakutat.
An unusually high percentage of climbers are topping out on North America's highest peak this summer. In a normal year, only about half the climbers attempting Denali reach the peak. But right now, the summit rate is 73%. It's the highest success rate recorded on the mountain since 1977. Park officials attribute the streak to relatively good weather during the busiest part of the climbing season. KTNA's Philip Manning has been following the action from Talkeetna. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Lori.
How excited are people about the climbing success rate?
Well, Talkeetna is a climbing town. It's always big news whenever there's big climbing events happening, and a high summit rate is good for the town in a lot of ways. It's good for the economy. The flight services have happy clients. The restaurants and lodgings have people who are happy to be here and often spend extra time here as a result. And Park Service is thrilled as well. Park Service is actually most thrilled not just about the summit rate, but about how safe this year has been, relatively speaking.
Well, in that vein of safety, has anyone died on the mountain this year?
There has been one death on the mountain. They've classed it as a medical death. The gentleman had a cardiac arrest while he was up there, and so they're not actually classifying that as a climbing fatality. So as far as that goes, there haven't been any climbing accidents resulting in death. And in fact, in general, the accidents have been down. Normally this time of year, Park Service conducts 15 search and rescues, and so far this year they've done 5.
Philip, has there been any downside to this warm weather?
There has been a bit. With the temperatures being as warm as they are on the mountain, there has been a very high level of rock fall as the ice that holds a lot of the rocks in place on the mountain, it just melts away, and so those rocks then are free to fall. Also, the glaciers are melting at a little bit faster rate than in most summers, and so then you have the risk of crevasses and things like that.
There's been a number of high-profile climbs, including the Centennial Climb, a group of 5 retracing the steps of the first successful Denali expedition. They summited on Friday. What can you tell us about their climb?
Well, they were actually following the exact route of the 1913 party that were the first to reach the summit. And the route that they took is actually very different from the one that most climbers take. Most climbers will go up the West Buttress, which is on the western portion of the mountain. But the Centennial group, they went up the Muldrow Glacier to the north side of the mountain, up by Brown's Tower, and then up to Denali Pass up the north side. So it's a much more technical climb, and in many ways a much more dangerous climb.
What about other high-profile climbs that happened this season?
There was a group who actually just recently left Talkeetna. It was the first all-African-American group. If they had summited, they would have been the first all-African-American group to reach the summit. Unfortunately, the day that they made their summit attempt was last Wednesday when there were thunderstorms rolling through the area. They got as high as 19,600 feet, the summit in sight, but the static electricity started to ramp up to a very dangerous level, and so they were forced to turn around and have since begun to return home.
Well, thank you, Philip, for giving us that update on the climbing season at Denali.
You're very welcome.
Philip Manning is a reporter with KTNA in Talkeetna.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Over the weekend, 21-year-old Jack Wiegan became the youngest person to fly solo around the world. Before making it back to California, though, he stopped in Unalaska, where KUCB's Stephanie Joyce caught up with him.
Customs agent Elmer Johnson and I watch from the window as the tiny single-engine Mooney Ovation hits the runway, then bounces, and finally comes to a jerky halt.
It wasn't the smoothest landing I've ever seen, but the old saying is, what, any landing you can walk away from is a good landing.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
You made it.
Yeah.
Out on the runway, Jack Wiegand unfolds himself from the cockpit.
Hey, welcome back.
Thank you. Oh, God.
It's been a while, huh?
It's been too long. I'm assuming you want to see my passport?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
As Johnson fills out paperwork, Wiegand takes the opportunity to stretch his legs.
This was a long flight. This was a long flight. Glad it's over.
It took Wiegand close to 12 hours to make the flight from Kushiro, Japan to Unalaska, even with 60 to 70 knot tailwinds. He says the original plan was to stop in Adak, where the community had arranged a welcome party for him, but the cloud ceiling was too low, and he had to continue on to Unalaska, which posed some challenges of its own.
Yeah, the most difficult approach I've done in my life.
Wiegand says he was running low on fuel by the time he reached Unalaska, so instead of doing a standard approach to the runway, he tried to fly in directly through the clouds.
It ended up on the other side of the, I guess it would have been over here, in the other bay, and they had to come back, and it was just a kind of a little bit of a mess getting in here, but I guess I'm here now, so that's okay.
That wasn't the first challenge Wiegand encountered on his 60-day journey around the world. In India, he wound up in the middle of a huge, unforecast thunderstorm while trying to make his way into Calcutta.
You're getting blown up and sucked down, and what I ended up having to do was find a little pocket in the hole in the clouds. It was a little hole in the clouds, and made really, really steep turns and just descended right down through the clouds and just popped right out, and I was underneath all of them.
In Japan, Wiegand ran into a different kind of problem. Bad weather kept him grounded in Kushiro for almost 3 weeks, giving him plenty of time to think about the Aleutian crossing that lay ahead.
This flight today was bigger than anything I ever wanted to take on. I mean, I was dreading this flight. This flight was over water the entire way. And over water that if you crash in for whatever reason, you're most likely not going to survive.
But survival wasn't the only thing on Wiegand's mind while he waited out the weather in Japan. He'd been hoping to make it home in time for his 21st birthday, but was stuck in Kushiro instead.
Which wasn't very exciting because the drinking age in Japan is already 20, so I could already do that. I mean, I never really had any exciting 21st birthday, but that'll yet to be celebrated.
And celebrations there were. When Wiegand landed in Fresno on Saturday, he was met with water cannons and well-wishers at the airport, and plenty of offers to buy him a cold beer. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Michigan-based team in Fairbanks is recovering and restoring what's left of an historic aircraft known as Sandbar Mitchell. Before starting their work, the group placed a plaque at the site of the plane crash that occurred on a Tanana River sandbar near Fairbanks 44 years ago. It remembers the Mitchell B-25 bomber that went down while in service as a firefighting air tanker on June 27, 1969. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The click of wrenches mixes with the chirp of birds and buzz of mosquitoes in a small sun-seared clearing in the willows along the Tanana River. A group of guys in black t-shirts with Sandbar Mitchell recovery team on them are disassembling a hunk of dull silver-colored wreckage. Their leader, Brighton, Michigan-based aircraft mechanic Patrick Mahalik, describes what they're after.
The piece here, the main section, is about 30 feet long from wingtip to wingtip, or where the stubs you'd call it. And then there's probably about a good 16 feet of actual fuselage.
It doesn't look worthwhile, but the center section is the backbone of an aircraft Mahalik plans to fully build out. Volunteer crew members David Fox and 15-year-old Logan Kacharik carefully remove a wing flap.
Last one. That's the last one. You ready? Yep, you're going to pull and give a little wiggle. Here we go. We're free. Okay. Well, you walk backwards.
Wait till you guys get that pulled off.
Cool. Excellent.
For 30-year-old World War II aviation fanatic Mahalik, getting the Sandbar Mitchell is a key step in a long journey.
This plane has fascinated me since I was probably Logan's age, and you know, I knew about it by doing research with the CAP records, and it just led one thing to another to being able to get a hold of the family, get the ownership rights of the airplane from the family, and then had all these great people up here in Alaska that helped us out, getting all the permits, all the necessary stuff with Fort Wainwright, and then the locals there volunteering, bringing us out here with their airboats and all that. I mean, we're just grateful.
Mahalik estimates there are only about 100 B-25s left in the world, including many in similar derelict condition. A pair of aviation documentary makers are in Fairbanks filming the recovery. Director Adam White understands the value of what looks like airplane junk.
It's almost worth any money to go and retrieve it. If you find a center section of a B-25 somewhere, go get it, because it's going to, whatever money's going to be spent is going to be less than recreating it.
White's partner, producer Kara Martinelli, describes the Sanbar Mitchell operation as atypical of restoration projects.
It's mostly a millionaire's club sort of thing, and this being a group that's paid to come out and volunteer and work on it is certainly says something about the people who are here.
This whole airplane has been done, as I call it, on a ramen noodle budget.
Mahalik and project partner Todd Trainer raised $27,000 through Kickstarter for the Fairbanks recovery operation and caught the attention of a Michigan-based construction company working in Alaska that's offered to helicopter Sanbar Mitchell off the river. No one died in the 1969 crash landing, but on Thursday, a memorial plaque was placed at the site. Trainer says the marker honors the plane and people connected to its story.
The owner of the B-25, Edgar Thurlswood, and the pilot of that airplane at the time of the crash, which is Herm Gallagher, and their families, both the Thurlswood family and the Gallagher family, have been huge supporters of our effort to recover this B-25 and have it flying again.
Trainer believes Sanbar Mitchell is more than a hunk of metal.
We're talking about an airplane with what we say has a soul and a spirit, all right, has sat there alone for 44 years. In fact, injured after some people have come by and hacked off some pieces off of it. And we are now there to rescue her after she has been in a remote location, bring her back to life.
Trainer and Mahalik pledge that if they can get Sanbar Mitchell restored, they'll fly it back to Fairbanks for a visit and offer rides. It may take a while. The old plane's center section will be lifted off its longtime resting spot in the Tanana River sometime in early July and then trucked to a hangar in Michigan for what's estimated to be a 15-year, up to $1 million restoration. The plane will be the centerpiece of a nonprofit Warbirds Museum recently founded by Mahalik. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld in Yakutat, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at crowleyalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in Good Health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.